This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are people around you who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made on our behalf. We want to preserve their stories so we understand just how great a price has been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we get to be educated, entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Rear Admiral Dick Lyon of Oceanside, California is our guest today. Folks here in Oceanside remember him as a two-term mayor, but his story goes back a lot deeper than that. And let's start with your days growing up in Pasadena. You're the second in a string of four brothers. What was that like in Pasadena in the 1930s?
Oh, it was great. It was a small town, still a little bit of a small town flavor to Pasadena. And with nothing but boys, we had four boys in the family, and it was great.
You remember some great Rose Bowls from those years?
We lived, our home happened to be on the Arroyo, right above the Rose Bowl. So I saw a lot of football games in the Rose Bowl, and I graduated from high school at Muir Tech High School in the Rose Bowl in 1940. As a freshman, I had just finished winning two CIF, California Interscholastic Federation, gold medals in swimming. I was 13 years old. Jackie Robinson was a senior at Muir Tech High School. You know, and when you finish your workouts for the day, whatever the sport, why everybody's hanging around the locker room, you take your showers together. And Jackie approached me after our workouts, and he said, "Dickie," yeah, that's me. He said, "I have a favor to ask of you." And I said, "Sure, what's going on?" And he said, "I have to tell you, I don't know how to swim." He said, "Obviously, you're swimming pretty well right at this point in your life." He said, "Could you give me a hand, and after our workouts, we can get into the pool," which is right there at between the girls' gym, the boys' gym, 25-yard pool, great pool. So we did that. We met in the pool, and I would put my hands under his back and tell him, "Okay, big breath now, Jackie, big breath," and I'd try to slip my hands out from under him. You may have done this with your kids. Yeah. And then phew, right down, and he come blustering back up to the surface. I said, "Okay, let's give it another try, another big breath." Well, we did that for almost 2 weeks, and the Friday of the second week I said, "Okay, ready for your lesson?" He said, "I think we're going to pass up on that." And I said, "Why, what's up?" And he said, "Well, I just don't think that I'm going to be able to make it as far as learning how to swim." He said, "But I have something that I'd like to tell you. I really appreciate what you've done." I mean, this is a senior high school telling a little freshman guy. He said, "I appreciate the help that you've given me." And he said, "It just didn't work out. So here's the deal. You take care of swimming, and I think you're going to go a long way." And he said, "And I will take care of all other sports." And so help me, that was a word for word, that was it. And what an incredible guy. Did he take care of the sports? As you know, he went on to UCLA, and he was just outstanding at UCLA. One of the most exciting broken field runners in football you ever saw.
And of course, a lot of people now only know him because he broke the color barrier, but it sounds like at Muir Tech and certainly at UCLA, there was no understanding of this prejudice or bias, and certainly it sounds like you didn't feel that.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, he's just a good guy, and what an athlete. I figured a real unusual thing that I would have that one-on-one experience with Jackie. Quite a guy, and as I think you may know, that he's the second in his family to achieve some fame. his brother Mac being in the 1936 Olympics, runner-up to Jesse Owens.
Well, and you mentioned the Olympics, and I was curious in hearing your swimming exploits. Was that a dream of yours? Did you think that you could be a Johnny Weissmuller or something?
Well, as a result of the high school swimming and my junior and senior year both, I was ranked nationally number one in both the 50 and 100 freestyle. That afforded me a trip to the Olympic tryouts in 1940, which happened to be in Santa Barbara. And I went up there as a almost graduate high school senior and managed to get through all the preliminaries and into the finals and wound up by being fourth in the 100-meter freestyle. And that assured me of a place on the team and a place on the relay team, which would have been a nice gold medal. Guess what? The games were canceled. And word to have been in Helsinki, and Hitler took care of that. That's the bad news, the game being canceled. The good news, the coach for the United States Olympic swimming team, of course, was there. I was a high school senior. He was also the coach at Yale, and guess where I went to college? The entire time that I was at college, why, we never lost a dual meet. And I had the pleasure of swimming anchor on a 400 freestyle relay, world's record, and was captain of the team that won the NCAA championships. We won those at Yale. We beat Michigan by 1 point and Ohio State by 2. And Yale dominated swimming. And the coach, Bob Kippeth, 5 Olympic teams, his dual meet record unsurpassed by any coach in any college sport, 529 victories over more than 41 years and 13 losses.
Pretty hard to top that. Wrapping up Jackie Robinson, before we move on to more of your experiences, I know you went off to World War II, but in between your experience in World War II and Korea is when he broke through in the big leagues. Was that something that you followed closely and were excited for him? And did you ever end up crossing paths with him again?
I absolutely did. You know, family right there in Pasadena. He played in a basketball league, and he was just a great all-around athlete. And as it turns out, a little less than a month ago, his daughter was a speaker at my wife's sister's group in Jamestown, New York. And one of the things that did come out was that Sharon's dad never did learn how to swim.
So I guess you shouldn't feel too bad, huh?
That's right.
So you go on to Yale, and I guess that's where you were when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember December 7th?
As a matter of fact, I was listening to New York Phil. I remember it's one of those photographic things. We all have those, and I just remember precisely. I can even tell you they were playing Tchaikovsky, Symphony No. 4, New York Philharmonic, on Sunday. And I was doing my studying, and they interrupted the program to say that word had just been passed that the Japanese had attacked our forces in Pearl Harbor. And that's when it broke out. I was a freshman at Yale. As it turns out, I was interviewed along with a couple of other of my swimming pals by the recruiter. We decided that, you know, less than a year later, that, hey, this is not something that's temporary. So we went to the recruiter, 3 of us. I was an engineering major. They were both in what we called academic at Yale College. One was history and the other was English. And the recruiter says, well, you two, we're taking you right away. As far as you got to stay here because you're an engineer, and we were told to leave the engineers alone. So I majored in metallurgical engineering. That was part of my job while I was there. I was on a scholarship and had a job fill out, and graduated in 2 years and 9 months, straight through, no vacations.
I don't know that too many people have done that, especially at some place like Yale. So then after graduation, what'd you do?
Right after graduation and about a week vacation, I reported in at Midshipman School, Columbia University in New York City. The way it worked, every one of the battalions. There were four battalions of 600 midshipmen, a total of 2,400 midshipmen at Columbia. Long and short of it, I was selected as a regimental commander for the entire 2,400, which, as it turns out, my own little stateroom on board the Prairie State, which was the old battleship Wyoming, tied alongside North River in New York City. And that's a three-month program there for midshipman school, during which time you, as a midshipman, become ultimately an officer and a gentleman in 90 days. And we were known at that time, for all of you senior people that are listening, I am a 90-day wonder. When I graduated, that's what happened for me. But 2 weeks before I graduated, notice on the bulletin board, which read, wanted volunteers for extra hazardous duty involving demolition of explosives. I thought, whoa, that's a new notice. And I looked again, and the fine print under it said, must be strong swimmer. Ah, there you go. And so I volunteered into that particular duty, and I went to Fort Pierce, Florida, for training with the United States Navy Special Warfare Scouts and Raiders.
And you'd never heard the term SEAL or Frogman or anything, and now you'll be speaking at the next, well, at Class 302 of the Navy SEALs. You ended up being part of Class Number 8, and we're going to talk about some of that Navy SEAL history. Dick was the first Navy SEAL to become an admiral, but at this point, you're saying scouts and raiders, explosives, swimming. This sounds like an adventure?
Doing recons and that sort of thing, and a swimming buddy, while we were going through scouts and raiders, wound up by going off to the China-Burma-India Theater of Operations, CBI, and I, on the other hand, went to the Pacific Command at Pearl Harbor and wound up doing a recon in Mindanao, this big southern island in the Philippines, for an amphibious assault, which never happened. I did the recon in August, and 4 days later, the bombs dropped.
Before we get to that, let's talk about the training, because you know better than anyone that the Navy SEALs now in their training, one of the big humps to get over that weeds out some of the guys who can't hack it is what they call Hell Week. Did you guys have something like Hell Week back in 1944?
We not only had it, we formed it. And it's the one thing that's carried on in Navy Special Warfare in a training aspect. Hell Week is part of the training now, which is a 61-week program for trainees down at Coronado, California. So we initiated that program. We had to do it because at that time, the relationship of you to your swimming buddy was number one. And we were told going right in by our instructors, if your buddy, for whatever reason, doesn't make it, neither do you. Out of a class of all officers, the last class to go through scout and raider training in 1944, 57, five lieutenants, junior grade, and the balance ensigns right out of college and midshipman schools all over the United States. And we didn't lose a single one. All 57 graduated.
Give us a taste of what that Hell Week was like, because that label makes it seem a little difficult and intensive and intimidating. What was the toughest part of it for you?
Well, it's gotten tougher and tougher and tougher ever since then, but I'm not about to tell any of the ones going through it now. You know, my words to those young men that are going through the training now, well, it's a piece of cake compared to when I went through it in 1944.
Well, I think they probably do have a little more sophisticated equipment now.
Pretty much the same. A lot of physical stress, where the emphasis comes down to really one thing, and that is determination. And mentally, you have to be there with regard to determination that you are going to become a Navy SEAL. Class 302, which is 300 classes after me in the Navy underwater demolition training. I was in class 2, and I'm mentoring, as I think you know, Paul, where I'm mentoring and Class 302. We started out on in-doc day, first day of training, with 170 young men who figured they were going to be Navy SEALs. 7 weeks later, I shook hands with those who completed Hell Week, but I only shook hands with 40.
Well, you talk about the cream of the crop. This is serious stuff. I know that was a long time ago, but was there any aspect of your training that you questioned whether or not you would have the determination or the stamina or the endurance or just the physical ability to get through it?
Absolutely, because I went through it again, second time. I was in class two for underwater demolition training.
Right.
Again, shortened significantly because of the fact that the Korean War was on at that time. I had to give up my educational pursuits at Stanford, where I was going for my MBA, and put in 2 years as a member of Underwater Demolition Team 5. Again, we had Hell Week. It was significantly more difficult than nearly every aspect of the training we had in Fort Pierce, Florida. One thing at Fort Pierce, Florida, we all kind of remembered is that part of the training is operating surreptitiously, and that meant hunkering right down to the best possible spot you can find where you won't be discovered. And Fort Pierce, Florida, when you get off of the beaten path and into the quote-unquote surrounding territory, sand fleas. We don't have them out here. Boy, I got to tell you, they all live in Fort Pierce, and they were waiting for us in 1944. To me, the thing that I recall is during Hell Week is trying to absolutely not move, and you could feel those little suckers just crawling all over me and something else.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's envying you in that position. Sounds hellish enough to me. It's break time on Hometown Heroes. When we come back, more from 90-year-old Dick Lyon. What kind of equipment did the Scouts and Raiders, predecessors of the Navy SEALs, have back in World War II? We'll find out as we explore his recon missions then and the rest of his trailblazing Navy career when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 90-year-old Rear Admiral Dick Lyon of Oceanside, California. I have some photos of Dick posted on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and I want to thank Bishop Eric Maniz of the Anglican Diocese of Fresno for introducing me to his friend Dick. Quite a story he has. We heard about how he tried to teach his high school friend Jackie Robinson how to swim, how he volunteered for extremely hazardous duty and became part of the Scouts and Raiders during World War II. And you mentioned, Dick, a recon mission toward the end of World War II at Davao in the Philippines on the island of Mindanao, swimming in the dark to scout out a potential Allied landing. Can you shed any more light on that?
I did the recon, and it was a good beach. No man-made or natural beach obstacles, and a good gradient, solid enough to support any kind of track, amphibious vehicles, and that sort of thing. So I reported very positively to my boss, the Commodore, and as I said, then the bombs dropped. In essence, the war in the Pacific was concluded. And I, at that point, said to Commodore Ryan, who was the boss, I've thought about it, and I think I'd like to get out and continue my education. And long pause, and he looked me right in the eye. He said, "Mr. Lyon, I have to tell you something. You don't have enough points." I said, "Oh, what does that mean?" He said, "Well, that means you're going to be here because we've just found that we will take these troops and pick up more of the 33rd Infantry Division out of Luzon and go on for occupation in Japan." And I said, "Okay, I guess that means I'm going along with you." And he laughed. He was really like, he's one of very few that was a mentor for me, a great man. So off we went to Japan, and I did another recon on a beach in a little city on Honshu, the big island, actually a village, really. Same thing, good beach. Having gone in, done the beach, and was ready to come out and be picked up by my LCVP, the Landcraft, and get back onto the APA. And I noticed that the little city, as you might expect, right at the end of the war, little village looked deserted. I mean, really, nobody. And as I looked, I observed three men, elderly, I could tell, my face mask on top of my head by that point, and I'm looking. And they came right down to the edge of the water, and I'm in the water up to about my shoulders, and I looked at them, and they looked at me. The man in the middle said, "I can see what you have just completed doing, and I understand what is happening. It's easy to see that a small landing will take place, relatively small, and I presume that this is being done all over our homeland. I want you to know that we will cooperate in any way that we can to make this peaceful and help in any way that we can to be sure that there are no additional casualties of any kind. And would you please be sure to pass this word to your superiors so that they know that there will be no opposition whatsoever?" And of course, I was just astounded that, wait a minute, all in perfect English, I thought. After a pause, I said, "I certainly will do that. And by the way, here in this little village," he kind of straightened up a little bit, and he said, "Well, I must let you know, I achieved my undergraduate baccalaureate degree from Harvard University." I couldn't let that one go. And then I just paused for literally 5 or 10 seconds, saying nothing. And I just looked at him, didn't say anything. And then I said, "Well, I have to tell you, I'm a Yalie. And we used to kick Harvard butt regularly on the football field." We both laughed, and as it turned out, he invited me to join, he and his wife, and I ran it by my boss, who said, "This is a golden opportunity for you. By all means, go in, have dinner with them, and enjoy." He said, "In whatever way, I think he kind of is the leader of what's left in this little place, and we need that cooperation." So I did that, and I went in armed with 2 cartons of Lucky Strike cigarettes. They were more than gold bars. He was just delighted to receive those. And after dinner, I got back to get my way back on the APA. And as I was leaving, he said, "I want you to have this." And he handed me a portfolio of 23 applique pictures, if you will, done by hand, applique, and then in the characters on the pictures, a story of how each of those persons became a samurai warrior. And so those samurai warriors are now adorning the wall behind me. You look right over my shoulder, you can see those, and I got those in 1945.
Well, they look great, and I'll throw some photos of those samurai warriors up on our Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You know, every time I interview somebody new, I hear stories that I've never heard before, and this is certainly up there. I can't imagine how mind-boggling that was to have that conversation on the beach. And just so people understand, you made it sound very mundane, these recon missions. Yeah, there's a good gradient. It was a good beach. But tell us how you did it. You mentioned your face mask and all that. Tell us what kind of equipment you had. Were you by yourself? Is this in the middle of the night in a rubber boat? Or were you just free swimming? How did this work?
Well, definitely free swimming. I went in. I have a lead line with which I would take the soundings, and a slate on which I would record the soundings and an indication where there might have been any natural or man-made obstacles. My uniform was a pair of swim trunks and swim fins. Do you remember the Churchill swim fins? You may recall those. No. They were a different shape, and that's where ultimately the Navy's underwater demolition teams became known in the Navy as frogmen, because with those swim fins on, why, you're the closest thing to looking like a frog as you could get. That was pretty much a face mask. I never went in the water without my K-bar, which is a knife, which was I had strapped on my lead belt. That's pretty much the uniform, quote unquote.
And when you interact with the guys who are going through SEAL training now, you remind them that that was the uniform you had, right? Because theirs is a little different?
Significantly so.
Did you feel like you were putting your life in danger?
You know, that not at any time did that occur to me. Well, yeah, well, almost not at any time. A couple of times. There's nothing like being shot at while you're in the water and by bad shots, happily. But the time that that one thought occurred to me, what am I doing here? It was in the Korean War in North Korea. I was in North Korea.
And so everyone understands you had come back, you were getting an MBA at Stanford, got called back up for the Korean War, actually ran into your brother while you're over there, but you're in Korea serving with Underwater Demolition Team 5?
I had been given temporary additional duty to Mine Round 3, Mine Squadron 3, which was inside Wonsan Harbor, well north into North Korea. It's a huge harbor, much bigger than San Francisco Harbor. We got some intelligence that there were mines there that we had not seen before, anti-amphibious assault mines, and my job was to find them, get them, that is, to recover them. And my armament at that point was a pair of 24-inch bolt cutters. My job, dive under the mine, put the cutters on the mooring cable, snip, and the mine would bob to the surface. We would take it, render it safe at one of the little islands, and as it turns out, those mines, which I managed to recover, were recently viewed by my niece at the mine headquarters at Solomons, Maryland.
And most of us have never done anything like this, so people know what they see in the movies, and they hear you talking about using your bolt cutters to make the mine take off. How do you do that? How do you neutralize a mine and make sure it's not going to detonate?
Are you ready for a short course in mine warfare? A mine, at the time that it's in the water, it's normally somewhere around 8 feet, thereabouts, will be struck, and it has a little horn on it, which if you break that little horn, it forms a battery, which in turn activates a charge which sets off what is called the detonator, and that in turn sets off the main charge of the mine. It is not armed as it is on the surface, but as it is pulled down below by the anchor mechanism and the mooring cable, there is what is called a hydrostatic safety switch, and the switch makes a contact so that at that point, if the horn is broken, it activates. If, on the other hand, it's on the surface, after I put the cutters on and it went to the surface, the switch, because of the water pressure no longer being there, opens up. And even at that point, if you break the horn, nothing would happen because there no circuit would be established. How's that for a quick course?
Well, that helps people understand, because I'm sure someone has a picture of you just flicking it with your fingernail and it blowing you out of the water.
No, Absolutely not. And that is the one thing, as I dove down on them with my cutters, the one thing I made doggone sure of, and this is, you asked me, were there any point when I figured, you know, hey, you know, and that's when it happened. And I said to myself, what in the world am I doing here, doing this? And if I make one wrong move, it's adios. So happily that didn't happen.
When you're down there diving, do you have supplemental oxygen? Do you have a way of breathing? Or is this just old-fashioned, you learn to hold your breath as long as you could?
You're getting into some pretty long time ago stuff. Not years, we're now talking decades. Now, I didn't have any kind of scuba gear, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. We used to talk about skinning it because I didn't have anything other than my armament, bolt cutters, and a K-bar knife.
How long could you hold your breath?
I could hold my breath for a minute plus, pretty well, and upwards into the second minute. But we had guys on the team that were unbelievable because they could go for double the time that I could.
See, and that to me seems like when you talk about finding yourself down there and saying, what am I doing here? One wrong move. To me, it's the double the pressure comes from the fact, how much oxygen do I have left? So you're racing against that clock that you don't have a display in front of your face saying 10 seconds left. You're just feeling it in your lungs and trying to figure out if you can snip it in time or you have to go back up and get a breath. That seems pretty stressful to me.
I was comfortable. I'm at that point in my life, hey, I'm more frog than man.
Ribbit, ribbit. You know, a lot of people refer to the Korean War as the forgotten war. And here you are, someone who served at the tail end of World War II. And you're so dialed into what's happening in our armed forces now, especially with the SEALs. What do you think is important for Americans to understand about the Korean War, what guys like you and your brother did, and what was accomplished during that time?
Well named, by the way, the Forgotten War. Most high school kids now, if you were to ask them, tell me what you know about the Korean War, they will look you right in the eye, and the response is, the what? So when you look at the casualties and the numbers that we lost in Korea and the battles that took place in Korea, very significant.
There are a lot of people that have different takes on what was accomplished and the fact that technically that war isn't necessarily over. But do you feel that there was some significant impact of that, that the spread of communism was stopped, or that the world would have looked different now if America hadn't done and what all those servicemen gave their lives for hadn't happened?
As it turns out, that had to happen with North Korea taking the active aggressor stand that they had taken. There was no alternative but to assist the South Korean and our allied forces. Not just the United States, the Allied forces did just that. Where would South Korea be today had we not joined forces with them? And of course, the 38th parallel now is the line. And Wonsan Harbor, where I did that mine work, is well north of that into North Korea. But, you know, take a look at South Korea is incredible, the way that they have taken hold and what they've managed to do economically is awesome.
And it wouldn't be that way without those like you who went over there, not without the more than 36,000 Americans who died in the Korean War, more than 100,000 more wounded. It's break time again, but when we come back, we're going to find out how a Navy SEAL became an admiral. That had never happened before. And we'll also explore what it really means to be a Navy SEAL. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with Rear Admiral Dick Lyon of Oceanside, California, originally from Pasadena. He likely would have earned an Olympic gold medal on a freestyle relay team if the 1940 Games had not been canceled because of the raging war in Europe. Instead, Dick made history in the Navy, and we've heard a fair amount of that journey so far, exploring some of his adventures in World War II and the Korean War. And you said, for the most part, you never really felt like your life was in danger. other than that moment you told us about. But in World War II or Korea, did you ever experience the loss of someone that you knew well?
Yeah. But you don't dwell on something like that. The impact is always there and still is. That's just part of serving, I think. As the saying goes, somebody had to do it, and our guys were there doing it, and a lot of them didn't make it.
Was there part of your training that prepared you for that, to almost know that you're putting yourself in that situation and maybe you can numb yourself to it a little bit? Or does it hurt just as much as it would one of us who hasn't gone through the training?
No, that never impacted me in any way. When you're in an organization that, in my case, went from scouts and raiders to underwater demolition to Navy SEALs, that's Navy Special Warfare, and that's something you don't sit around and dwell on, frankly.
Just kind of understood. It goes with the territory?
Precisely that.
Well, speaking of Navy Special Warfare, now you told us at the end of World War II, you told your superior officer that you wanted to go home and he had to give you the bad news you didn't have enough points. After Korea, did you decide you wanted to be a Navy man? Were you thinking right there, hey, I want to do 4 decades in the Navy?
Things have a way of turning out. Went back, got my MBA, but I stayed in a reserve component of Navy Special Warfare, and that's all I did as a reservist. Was always oriented toward Navy Special Warfare. So the Navy system has what are called selection boards, and as you become eligible for promotion to your next rank, next grade, you go before a selection board. Well, I'd gotten all the way up to captain as a naval reservist with active duty in World War II and Korea, and actually was a Navy SEAL, having achieved that through going to all that I needed to do, including jump school, which I did at Lakehurst, New Jersey in the dead of winter, which was not exactly a lot of fun, but I did it. That's kind of where I was. And as a captain, I went before the selection board in my first year of eligibility for promotion. And of course, I got turned down because at that point, Navy Special Warfare did not have any flag officers, admirals. So I was not at all surprised. I figured, well, okay, I've got one more year to go. I'll get another look. Meanwhile, I'm going to enjoy myself. So I, again, stayed active as I was able to. And much to my astonishment, when I got my second look, I got a phone call from the Pentagon. A very senior admiral said to my son, who answered the phone at the time, I want to speak to Admiral Lyon. We'd just finished running on the beach. We lived in Balboa at the time. And he pounded on the door and he said, Dad, he said, there's some guy, says he's from the Pentagon, and he wants to talk to Admiral Lyon. And I opened the shower door and said, what? Give me the phone. So I took the phone, and sure enough, that was the call.
So that made you the first SEAL ever to become an admiral. And when you think about those men throughout all these years, from the scouts and raiders to the frogmen of the UDTs to the SEALs coming in the 60s and what they're doing now, how much pride does that give you to be the first SEAL to become an admiral?
That happened, and my date of rank is 1 July 1974, the first Navy SEAL admiral.
What does that mean to you?
Aside from being, as I think about it, any time I think about it, which is not that often, I think, what? How did that happen? But it did, and as it turns out, the next Navy SEAL to achieve the grade of admiral was not until 11 years later, and he is down in Coronado, a very, very close friend, widely known in the SEAL community. His name is Irish Flynn.
What were you up to during the Vietnam era?
I never got called back. Again, I was in command of the largest reserve division in the United States when the Navy looked for a reserve flag officer to come back on active duty to be the senior reserve officer in the Navy on active duty. And as it turns out, they picked me. And I went down to New Orleans. If you're in the Navy and you have to go to someplace like New Orleans for your final tour, nothing could be nicer.
A lot better than swimming in your swim trunks in the Pacific, huh?
Absolutely right. So
I get the sense that that distinction you have as the first admiral to come from the ranks of the SEALs leaves you with a sense of responsibility, and maybe that's why you continue to give back to those who are coming through now. I mean, the fact that at age 90, you're mentoring a class of future SEALs that are hoping to graduate here in the next month. What kind of satisfaction do you get out of that?
Again, Paul, I think you put your finger right on it. The Navy SEALs are, in a word, unique. There's nothing that compares to that Navy Special Warfare unit, and it's the only one. We now have 12 flag officers on active duty. The commander of all special operation forces is a 4-star Navy admiral whose name is Bill McCraven. And Admiral McCraven was the one at the time he was at JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, at Fort Bragg at the time that, in essence, he planned, executed, in every sense of the word, the operation which took out Osama bin Laden. He, by the way, is Bullfrog 15. I was Bullfrog 1.
So that's what you're called if you're a SEAL who becomes an admiral, you're a bullfrog?
No. The bullfrog is that SEAL, officer or enlisted, who is on active duty and has the longest tenure in Navy Special Warfare. Well, so I went back to Scouts and Raiders, and so I was, at the time it was decided to make this little arrangement within the Navy SEAL community, I wound up as Bullfrog 1, and Bill McCraven now is Bullfrog 15, and he will be retiring this year, and so whoever succeeds him will become Bullfrog 16.
Quite a small fraternity there.
That's a very tight one.
What strikes you about the would-be SEALs that you meet? What are the you said unique. What are the things that they possess that so many others don't that helps them become Navy SEALs?
I'm having a lot of fun doing this with the class, and I've met with them so far maybe, I think, 5 times. I have told them either you have to have the determination that you will make it or you won't. It's that simple. If you don't have that determination, you're not going to make it. The class is now 43. They will go all the way through. They finish what is called Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training, called BUDS. And that's the first 3 months of the training. The balance of the time, they are in what's called S, as in sugar, QTs, SEAL Qualification Training. And that brings them up to a total of well over a year, 61 weeks. Total time training.
Well, and you mentioned the bin Laden operation with SEAL Team 6, and there's just an example of the kind of work that they can do. Does it ever trouble you when something like that happens, the amount of speculation that gets out there because this work is so unique and in some ways so secretive and so anonymous that all kinds of different ideas, theories, speculative thoughts get out there in the media? What's your take on all of that?
My take is whatever the take of the senior guy, and I'm talking about Admiral McCraven, and he is saying, okay, hey, let's just keep this as, you know, at as low a level as at all possible. This is not something that we're out there doing. Looking for a hoopla, rah-rah. That's been the difficult part. And a lot of media publication, for instance, you just mentioned SEAL Team 6. Well, there is no SEAL Team 6. That's the Navy Special Warfare Group, DEV Group, and the development group, and it's at Damneck. And there was a SEAL Team 6, but It was decommissioned some years ago. And so now Dev Group is, and where SEAL Team 6 came from, somebody dug it up. Thank you, media. I don't know.
Wow. Well, if anyone really knows, I know we're talking to the guy. You have on your lapel, and we're just hanging out on the beach here in Oceanside. You've got a great front porch here with the surf crashing right in front of your deck. So we're hanging out here on the beach, casual, and you've got your polo shirt on, but you still have a little pin on your lapel. It's gold-colored, and it's something that's pretty hard to obtain. Tell us what's on your collar there.
That's a miniature trident. Actually, you can barely see it, but it fits very nicely on my collar, and amazing the number of times somebody, and I wear it just about, it's part of me. I've had so many occasions where I will be somewhere and somebody will come up and say, that's a SEAL trident you're wearing, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it's interesting, you would recognize it. And he said, well, I'm retired SEAL or I'm on team whatever. And invariably, the next question will be, that person would ask me, well, what class were you? And I have a lot of fun at that point by saying, well, Scouts and Raiders or Underwater Demolition? And they'll look at me like, well, UDT, I guess. Well, Class 2. Come on. They usually, come on.
Well, part of that is that you just don't look 90, huh?
You have to ask my wife about that. She's the one that runs the show around here.
What does that trident mean to you? It seems like you take great pride in it.
I absolutely do. It's the trident is very meaningful because the composition of this little device, which is like the naval aviator's gold wings, the trident identifies Navy SEALs at this point. The name SEAL is not, we didn't run around and finally decided, what do we call it, Navy SEALs or walruses? Or no. SEAL actually has a real meaning, and the S is the first letter C, which is the medium in which we conduct our direct operations. So C, air, and land. SEAL. How about that? Comes out.
Sea, air, land. And this was not something you came up with, but it's something I know you believe in. And every time a new SEAL class graduates, and you're a part of quite a few of those. In fact, you were just at a graduation here in November, and you handed me this program. And it has in here the SEAL ethos. I guess this is how you program your brain to understand who you are once you become a SEAL. It starts, in times of war or uncertainty, there is a special breed of warrior ready to answer our nation's call. A common man with uncommon desire to succeed. Forged by adversity, he stands alongside America's finest special operations forces to serve his country and the American people and to protect their way of life. I am that man. Does that just represent the calling, the responsibility? When you hear those words, what does it mean?
Well, first off, the ethos, that's the first paragraph of 9 short ones in the SEAL ethos, which is not that old. It's only less than about a decade at this point. The commander of the Navy Special Warfare Training Unit at the time was Captain Joe McGuire. He convened a group of senior combat officers and enlisted, and tasked them to come up with a language which would, for every Navy SEAL, would identify, here's who you are. This is now who you are. And right up to this very point, this did not apply to you. But once you are a Navy SEAL, it does. That's what we're looking at. As you can see, the last short words, I am that man.
And I think a lot of people just think of it as a physical process of the grueling training that produces a new physical specimen. But you talked about determination as being the biggest factor. And this ethos, I guess, maybe is the capstone of that mental and psychological transformation. Let me read the rest of it, and then you can tell me what stands out to you, maybe what's most important or significant to you. We heard that first part, and the next paragraph starts, "My trident is a symbol of honor and heritage bestowed upon me by the heroes who have gone before. It embodies the trust of those whom I have sworn to protect. By wearing the trident, I accept the responsibility of my chosen profession and way of life. It is a privilege that I must earn every day. My loyalty to country and team is beyond reproach. I humbly serve as a guardian to my fellow Americans, always ready to defend those who are unable to defend themselves. I do not advertise the nature of my work, nor seek recognition for my actions. I voluntarily accept the inherent hazards of my profession, placing the welfare and security of others before my own. I serve with honor on and off the battlefield. The ability to control my emotions and my actions, regardless of circumstance, sets me apart from other men. Uncompromising integrity is my standard. My character and honor are steadfast. My word is my bond. We expect to lead and be led. In the absence of orders, I will take charge, lead my teammates, and accomplish the mission. I lead by example in all situations. I will never quit. I persevere and thrive on adversity. My nation expects me to be physically harder and mentally stronger than my enemies. If knocked down, I will get back up every time. I will draw on every remaining ounce of strength to protect my teammates and to accomplish the mission. I am never out of the fight. We demand discipline. We expect innovation. The lives of my teammates and the success of the mission depend on me, my technical skill, tactical proficiency, and attention to detail. My training is never complete. We train for war and fight to win. I stand ready to bring the full spectrum of combat power to bear in order to achieve my mission and the goals established by my country. The execution of my duties will be swift and violent when required, yet guided by the very principles I serve to defend. Brave men have fought and died, building the proud tradition and feared reputation that I am bound to uphold. In the worst of conditions, the legacy of my teammates steadies my resolve and silently guides my every deed. I will not fail." That's a pretty high standard to hold yourself to. What, of all those words, what really stands out to you as the epitome of a SEAL?
What can I say?
You emotional hearing all those words?
Yeah, those words were very carefully worked over so that when these young men are awarded their tridents, complete their training, and are assigned to teams, that's then who they are, every one of them. It's a very, very, very close brotherhood.
And one of the common threads, just as I read that, really for the first time to read that all in that chunk like that, the common thread that seems to run through it all is one of putting others before themselves. And we think of those who have fallen, the 400,000 in World War II, the thousands since in Korea and Vietnam and the Persian Gulf and the wars that are still raging on today. And I think of the verse in the Bible that says, greater love has no man than this, than he lay down his life for his friend. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you lived this, you have lived this now for almost 70 years. I guess it is 70 years now. Is that what it was all about for you, being willing to put yourself in someone else's place and give up your life for someone else's?
There was nothing in writing at that point in time, and I think that's why Admiral McGuire, then a captain, said, hey, we need to have something which is going to apply to these young men, which lets them know what is expected of them, who they are, and that's exactly what that is. Every one of those young men that graduate, when you meet a Navy SEAL, that's who he is. He's not advertising it, or the closest thing that I come to doing is wearing this because I want to meet as many of my brothers as I can possibly meet. And it's amazing that I've had it happen in airports.
Yeah.
There's no way I can modify anything by words that I can, Paul, that I can say to you right now other than what you just read, because that's it right there.
And to truly live up to all that does take a very unique and special person. And we've sure been hearing from one in this conversation with Dick Lyon, 90 years old, of Oceanside, California. If you ever lived in Oceanside, maybe he was your mayor, spent 8 years doing that. What keeps you going? Because I said you don't look 90, and I'll put the picture online to prove it for those who want to look you up. I know you have 9 children and 15 grandchildren and even some great-grandchildren now. None of them ever would have been here if you didn't make it back from those wars, I suppose. When you think about all that, the life that you've led, you ever go back and say, you know, how different my life would have been if I didn't volunteer when I saw that little notice posted for the extremely hazardous volunteer duty?
Absolutely. Things have happened in my life like that. If I had not seen that notice, my whole life would have been different. And I have had that experience over a lot of years in my life. And I have to think that, you know, the Lord is looking over me. Absolutely. Circumstances where I met Cindy, incredible, because I became involved in founding a children's hospital in Orange County. And with serving as president of that board of trustees and doing my rounds in that facility in the hospital, went in to see a little boy, leukemia kid, that I'd gotten to know because I did my rounds. And little Michael Barnett said, "Oh," he said, "Dick, I'm so glad you came in today. I want you to meet my new nurse, Cindy."
And how long you been married now?
Almost 40 years. You think, how did that happen? Why are those things? I can give you a litany, Paul, of almost that same kind of thing.
Well, I'm not arguing with your theory that God had a plan for you. I guess the only other thing that I need to ask you, and feel free to add anything, I definitely want to say thank you for serving our country and continuing to serve those men who are following in your footsteps now. This may be a tough one to answer, but what are you most proud of? What gives you the most satisfaction with the way all these years have unfolded?
I've found that as I'm now pretty well into my senior years, the most pleasure in my life comes to me from those precious little grandchildren. My kids are okay. But I absolutely adore the little ones. Yeah, my family is so important to me now. A lot of things have happened in my life, and this has happened to me a lot, where I say, why me? I haven't got an answer for that.
Well, maybe you still have some time to figure it out.
Yeah, right.
Get back to me if you do.
Okay, I sure will.
That is 90-year-old Dick Lyon of Oceanside, California, the first Navy SEAL to become an admiral. We learned a lot about the SEALs, didn't we? There was a little more to our conversation that I couldn't quite squeeze into the time allowed, and as always, you can find the full-length podcast, even those parts that didn't make the show, at hometownheroesradio.com. You'll find some photos of Dick on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and I hope you'll find time for our next episode when I sit down with a New Mexico man who spent more than 3 years as a prisoner of the Japanese. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes this time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.